Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 29, Wonder Woman's real-life origin story. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to talk about Wonder Woman. For our generation, Wonder Woman probably evokes a mental image of the Linda Carter TV show, and a younger set will someday think of the upcoming movie. But Wonder Woman actually debuted in December of 1941. Just as the attack on Pearl Harbor was drawing the U.S. into World War II. In the comics, Wonder Woman's origin story said that she was born to a race of Amazon women from Paradise Island, then disguised herself as Boston career woman Diana Prince. In real life, Wonder Woman was inspired by the early feminist fights for suffrage and access to contraception, and she was the brainchild of one very unique family who called Cambridge home. But before we pull back the curtain on Wonder Woman, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is May 15th, and on May 15th, 1775, the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts sent a letter to the Native Americans of Maine, which was then still part of Massachusetts, trying to recruit them to the Patriot cause. "Brothers, the great wickedness of such as should be our friends but are our enemies, we mean the Ministry of Great Britain, have laid deep plots to take away our liberty and your liberty. They want to get all our money, make us pay it to them when they never earned it, to make you and us their servants, and let us have nothing to eat, drink, or wear but what they say we shall, and prevent us from having guns and powder to use to kill our deer and wolves and other game, or to send you for you to kill your game with, and to get skins and furs to trade with us for what you want. The Englishmen of all the colonies from Nova Scotia to Georgia have firmly resolved to stand together and oppose them. Our liberty and your liberty is the same. We are brothers. What is for our good is for your good. And we, by standing together, shall make those wicked men afraid and overcome them, and all be freemen. We want to know what you, our good brothers, want from us of clothing or warlike stores, and we will supply you as fast as we can. We will do all for you that we can, and fight to save you any time. Our good brothers, the Indians at Stockbridge, all join with us. And some of their men have enlisted as soldiers, and we have given them that enlisted each one a blanket and a ribbon, and they will be paid when they are home in the service. And if any of you are willing to enlist, we will do the same for you." Now that's some first-class white-splaining. How does a blanket and a ribbon compare to the enlistment bounties paid in cash to white soldiers?
On May 16th, 1631, the young town of Boston got quite a fright. It had only existed for a few months at that point, having been officially founded on September 7th, 1630, by white settlers who were growing frustrated with the lack of access to clean water in Charlestown. That night, Thomas Prince's History of the Colony records, "May 16th, an alarm to all our towns in the night, by a piece shot off, but where could not be known. And the Indians, having sent us word the day before that the Mohawks are coming down against them and us." The town, due to the Mohawks not arriving, continued to exist.
Wednesday is May 17th, and we honor a joyous anniversary in Massachusetts. Just after midnight on May 17th, 2004, the first same-sex marriages in the U.S. were performed at Cambridge City Hall. Marcia Caddish and Tanya McCloskey were the first happy couple to complete their paperwork, rush upstairs, and be pronounced wife and wife by the city clerk D. Margaret Drury, becoming the first legally wed gay couple in the United States. A spontaneous celebration broke out on the street below.
In our lifetime, we never thought that this would happen. And it has, and it's a very emotional time. We considered civil union, but we knew that that was not equal in its rights. And when marriage started to happen, we said we must do it as soon as possible. And so that's why we're here tonight.
The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court had ruled the prior November in the case of Goodridge v. Department of Health that marriage is a vital social institution. The exclusive commitment of two individuals to each other nurtures love and mutual support. It brings stability to our society. For those who choose to marry, and for their children, marriage provides an abundance of legal, financial, and social benefits. In return, it imposes weighty legal, financial, and social obligations. The question before us is whether, consistent with the Massachusetts Constitution, the Commonwealth may deny the protections, benefits, and obligations conferred by civil marriage to two individuals of the same sex who wish to marry. we conclude that it may not. The Massachusetts Constitution affirms the dignity and equality of all individuals. It forbids the creation of second-class citizens. It only took the Supreme Court of the United States 11 years to catch up.
Abigail Adams wrote to John on May 18, 1778, in the midst of the American Revolution, saying, "Difficult as the day is, cruel as this war has been, separated as I am on account of it from the dearest connection in life, I would not exchange my country for the wealth of the Indies, or be any other than an American, though I might be queen or empress of any nation upon the globe. My soul is unambitious of pomp or power. Beneath my humble roof, blessed with the society and tenderest affection of my dear partner, I have enjoyed as much felicity and as exquisite happiness as falls to the share of mortals. And though I have been called to sacrifice to my country, I can glory in my sacrifice and derive pleasure from my intimate connection with one who is esteemed worthy of the important trust devolved upon him."
Friday is May 19th. On May 19th, 1713, we find this entry in the diary kept by Judge Samuel Sewell. "Visited Mr. Blower. Got to Brothers at Salem about 7 and lodged there. By this means, I was not entangled with the riot committed that night in Boston by 200 people or more, breaking open Arthur Mason's warehouse in the common, thinking to find corn there. Wounded the Lieutenant Governor and Mr. Newton's son. Cried whalebone. Were provoked by Captain Belcher sending Indian corn to Curacao. The selectman desired him not to send it. He told him the hardest, finned off. If they stopped his vessel, he would hinder the coming in of 3 times as much." This was the last in a series of 3 riots by Boston's poor between 1710 and 1713. At the time, the town relied on grain from rural farms as the staple of the average diet, and there was an ongoing grain shortage. With the shortage, farmers and merchants had incentive to hoard what supply there was in order to drive up prices. And with Queen Anne's War raging against the French, it was hard to trade with other colonies for food. In the spring of 1713, Captain Andrew Belcher had a surplus of grain and was planning a shipment to Curacao. Though Reverend Cotton Mather cautioned, "'Tis the Lord who has taken away from you what he has given to others," some 200 poor citizens of Boston had other plans. They rioted on the common, attacking Belcher's and other warehouses. In the end, the colony would prevent merchants from exporting grain during times of shortage, and the town of Boston set a fixed price for grain and established a public granary for the poor.
In the early days of our revolution, there was a lot of confusion about what the new army's policy would be on enlisting people of color. There were ever-changing decisions on whether to enlist free blacks or enslaved people. On May 20th, 1775, the Massachusetts Committee of Safety made the choice not to enlist enslaved people. "Resolved, that it is the opinion of this committee, as the contest now between Great Britain and the colonies respects the liberties and privileges of the latter, which the colonies are determined to maintain, that the admission of any persons as soldiers into the army now raising, but only such as are freemen, will be inconsistent with the principles that are to be supported, and reflect dishonor on this colony, and that no slaves be admitted into this army upon any consideration whatsoever." You can see why enslaved people would eventually flock to British lines and the promise of freedom they held out.
Finally, Sunday is May 21st. May 21st, 1775 was also a Sunday, and that morning the British landed a party of about 100 soldiers on Grape Island in Boston Harbor. Elisha Levitt was owner of the island at the time, and he was a staunch loyalist. He'd offered to sell or give hay and livestock to the British, and they had sent 2 sloops and an armed schooner to accept his offer. Grape Island is just barely off the shore of Weymouth, so the British party was in full view of the town. Soon, 2,000 militia had gathered, and they were soon joined by 3 companies from the rebel camp at Roxbury. The two parties traded a few shots across the narrow stretch of water for several hours, with little effect, until the tide came in and the Patriot Party managed to find a few boats. As many men as could possibly squeeze on board the small boats did so, and stormed ashore on Grape Island, just as the British packed up and set sail from the other side. 3 British soldiers were wounded, and the rebels burned the remaining hay on the island, a barn, and commandeered the remaining livestock.
this week's anniversaries were skewed heavily toward the Revolutionary War, and this isn't a Revolutionary War podcast. Living here, in the cradle of liberty, it just works out that way sometimes. If you're sick of the Revolution, you'll be happy to hear that this week's show is strictly modern history.
In a 1941 issue of All-Star Comics, Queen Hippolyte explains to her daughter Diana, "In the days of ancient Greece, many centuries ago, we Amazons were the foremost nation in the world. In Amazonia, women ruled and all was well. After men conquered and enslaved women, the Amazonians retreated to a secret enclave called Paradise Island, where they lived in peace until Captain Steve Trevor crash-landed his plane there. Diana rescued him and used her invisible plane to fly him back to America, the last citadel of democracy and of equal rights for women. It was the world's introduction to Wonder Woman."
In your satin tights, fighting for our rights, and the all red, white, and blue.
The man who created this feminist icon was deeply affected by the women's suffrage movement, having witnessed women chain themselves to the gates of the Harvard campus while he was a student there. He belonged to the Harvard Men's League for Women's Suffrage, even as Harvard barred his wife and other women from enrolling. He counted the founders of Planned Parenthood among his immediate family. Wonder Woman drew as much from the Varga girls, who were pinups in Esquire magazine, as she did from these early feminist figures, and she was directly inspired by the women in her creator's life. Wonder Woman's trademark exclamation, "Suffering Sappho," was taken from one of these women, and her looks and bulletproof bracelets of submission were taken from the other.
The true story of Wonder Woman's origin begins in Boston with a woman named Elizabeth Holloway. Holloway was raised in Boston and got her bachelor's degree from Mount Holyoke College in 1915. Keep in mind that it was very unusual for a woman to receive higher education at that time, while she would go on to earn 3 degrees. As a sign of the times, when she asked her father for help with tuition, he reportedly told her, "Absolutely not. As long as I have money to keep you in aprons, you can stay home with your mother." That comment came when Holloway wanted to follow her boyfriend to law school. That boy was William Moulton Marston from Saugus. The two had met in 8th grade, and they'd been sweet on each other ever since. Marston had recently graduated from Harvard and planned to go back and continue his studies at Harvard Law. As Holloway would later say, "Those dumb bunnies at Harvard wouldn't take women, so I went to Boston University." When her father refused to pay for her law school tuition, she sold cookbooks to local ladies' clubs to raise the money, and by fall, she had what she needed. She entered BU Law in the fall of 1915, and that same September, they were married. She became Elizabeth Holloway Marston, despite not being thrilled with the idea of taking a man's name, saying, "We are stuck with either our father's name or our husband's, so choose the one you like best. There's no such thing in this civilization as your own name." Even after the wedding, she continued to pay her own tuition. Both Marstons graduated from their respective law schools in 1918, with Elizabeth one of just 3 women to earn a law degree from BU that year. When it came time to take the Massachusetts bar exam, Elizabeth later reported, "I finished the exam in nothing flat and had to go out and sit on the stairs waiting for Bill Marston and another Harvard man to finish." I too finished the bar exam early.
Both Marstons had undergraduate degrees in psychology, and since they were both total underachievers, they decided to go into psychological research after passing the bar exam. Bill Marston was accepted into a doctoral program at Harvard, working under the prominent psychologist Hugo Munsterberg. Of course, it was not a program that was open to women. Elizabeth enrolled in a master's program down the street at elite Radcliffe College. Despite the disparity in the opportunities available to them, Elizabeth seems to have entirely held her own with Bill. She performed experiments with him, helped him write his dissertation, and even filled in for him when he didn't feel like delivering lectures to his undergraduate courses. It was during this close partnership that Elizabeth had the breakthrough that would make William Marston famous. While Bill was experimenting with blood pressure machines in Munsterberg's lab, Elizabeth pointed out that when she got mad or excited, her blood pressure seemed to climb. Bill had always been interested in how to compel someone to be truthful, and jumped on the connection to elevated blood pressure. he started marketing a fairly simple sphygmomanometer, or blood pressure cuff, as a lie detector. He tried desperately to interest courts and police agencies in this new invention, with little success. His invention was used in a series of marketing stunts for movies and commercial products. I was excited when I stumbled across William Moulton Marston's FBI file in researching this episode. I thought maybe he'd been investigated as a communist or something like that. But it's mostly a record of his desperate attempts to interest FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover in the lie detector. It also contains evidence that the lie detector only worked when administered by Marston himself. It also shows that Marston falsified the results of a test performed as part of a marketing campaign for Gillette razors, and he attempted to pay off the participants. A 1939 letter from an FBI agent to J. Edgar Hoover describes how men shaved with Gillette razors and then a competing brand, and were immediately asked which they preferred while hooked up to the lie detector. According to Redacted, Redacted conducted experiments with a small group of individuals and padded the results so as to show that the Gillette blades were superior. Redacted and his associates in the Detroit Police Department then assisted Marston in carrying the experiment farther and making a test with a larger number of individuals. Redacted stated that the interrogation engaged in with his assistants showed about 50% of the individuals tested indicated Gillette blades to be superior, and about 50% indicated the other blades to be superior. Marston was not satisfied with this latter test, and then confidentially advised an associate of Redacted that if this associate would swear to results indicating that all the individuals believed Gillette to be superior, there would be a good sum of money in it, not only for Marston, but also for this associate of Redacted. The associate declined to perjure himself in this fashion, and, apparently, the entire scheme fell through as far as the Detroit area was concerned. Marston indicated on that occasion that he stood to make around $30,000 for his part in this entire scheme. So it wasn't communist subversion, but it wasn't very flattering either. And it makes it perfectly clear why those early lie detectors weren't admissible in court, much as polygraphs aren't today.
While Bill Marston was working on his early prototypes of a lie detector, he completed his PhD from Harvard in 1921. Not to be outdone, Elizabeth completed her master's at Radcliffe that same year. Soon, Bill took a position teaching at Tufts. There, a young woman named Olive Byrne took classes with him. Olive was the daughter of Ethel Byrne, a fearsome fighter for women's sex education and access to birth control. Ethel's sister was the better-known activist Margaret Sanger, and the two of them founded Planned Parenthood. Soon after Olive's birth, she was given up as an orphan so her mother could pursue her cause. Ethel was eventually imprisoned in 1917 for distributing information about birth control. While in prison, she went on a hunger strike, and as she hovered near death, Margaret Sanger negotiated for her freedom. In order to improve Ethel's public image, Margaret plucked young Olive from the orphanage where she lived, claiming that Ethel had been arrested while in the midst of reuniting with her long-lost child. In her graduation photo, Olive Byrne stands with Professor Marston, and they're flanked on either side by Elizabeth Holloway Marston and Olive's mother, Ethel. In 1926, 22-year-old Olive would move into the Marston household. It's unclear how much say Elizabeth had in this decision. Some accounts say that William issued an ultimatum. Either she could accept Olive into their lives, or she could leave. In the end, she found a way to capitalize on the arrangement. Olive, having been raised in orphanages and by absent parents, wanted a family more than anything else. And Elizabeth had found her professional ambitions thwarted by the demands of marriage and motherhood. They reached an arrangement in which Elizabeth would work while Olive took care of the family. Ultimately, each woman had two children with William Marston. To the outside world, Olive pretended to be the widow of a man named Mr. Richard. She would take on the persona of a housekeeper or distant relative. Years later, the editor of DC Comics would visit the Marstons at home, saying, "Betty Marston was the mother, Dotsie Richard was the secretary. There were other people who needed homes and got them, and they all operated beautifully." Elizabeth took this opportunity to become a career woman. She indexed the documents of the first 14 Congresses, lectured on law, ethics, and psychology at American and New York universities, and served as an editor for Encyclopedia Britannica and McCall's magazine. Eventually, she would take a position as assistant to the president of the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company and work there until she was 65. Her salary would pay for the entire family. While Byrne raised the children and Bill lurched from one job to another, Elizabeth brought home the bacon.
The Marston's family extended beyond the immediate household. As The Atlantic put it, they had a polyamorous relationship with another woman, Marjorie W. Huntley, before they met Byrne, and she remained an on-and-off member of the family long after Byrne arrived, helping out with the inking and lettering of the Wonder Woman comics in the 1940s, and occasionally staying with Holloway and Byrne after Marston's death. Further, Huntley, Byrne, Holloway, and Marston all participated in what was described as a sex cult in 1925 and 26 at the home of Marston's aunt Carolyn. Participants celebrated female sexual power, dominance, submission, and love by forming love units consisting of multiple partners, including love girls, who do not practice concealment of the love organs. Translated from New Age, that means they didn't wear clothes. Perhaps it shouldn't be a surprise that William Moulton Marston published a book in 1928 called Emotions of Normal People, dedicated to his mother, Elizabeth Holloway Marston, Marjorie Wilkes Huntley, and Olive Byrne. In it, he defended a wide range of sexual practices as being within the realm of normalcy, including bondage, polyamory, and homosexuality. In the midst of a wonkish book on applied psychology, he makes a plea for his fellow humans to treat their own emotions as normal, and not something to be hidden. Thus, human beings, by adhering to the general type of observable behavior in their own group, learn to regard more than one half of their normal selves as abnormal. In order to continue to be thought normal, they must continue to regard their own natural, secret behavior as abnormal. Moreover, though they may have a shrewd suspicion that other members of their particular group are behaving in secret very like themselves, they quickly learn to regard such secret normalcy of their fellows, whenever discovered, as disgustingly abnormal also. Upon learning that neighbor John Smith is secretly enjoying a true love relationship with a woman who could not advantageously be presented as Mrs. Smith, each secretly normal individual quickly denounces Smith's conduct with all the virulence at his command. Another stone has been added to the burden of abnormality under which humanity is laboring. The book's unorthodox thesis, combined with a growing public awareness of the Marstons' unconventional family arrangement, to torpedo William Moulton Marston's academic career. In rapid succession, he went from being a full professor, to an untenured assistant professor, to having a one-year appointment as a lecturer. As an undergrad, Marston had helped make ends meet by selling screenplays, and as his academic career crashed down around him, he saw a help-wanted ad from Universal Pictures. Wanted: a psychologist. Somewhere in this country, there is a practical psychologist, accomplished in the science of the mind, who will fit into the Universal organization. He can be of real help in analyzing certain plot situations and forecasting how the public will react to them. As moving pictures are reaching out more and more for refinements, such a mental showman will have great influence on the screens of the world. He got the job, and the family moved west to L.A. Bill found all kinds of ways to apply psychology to the movie business, sometimes soberly, by showing a movie to 1,000 college students with the ending omitted to attempt to measure the degree to which audiences could handle unfinished business, and sometimes as pure spectacle, hooking blondes and brunettes up to his so-called lie detector, then interrogating them while playing love scenes to see who had a greater love reaction.
Dr. William Marston tests his latest invention, the love meter. He's going to find out whether blondes or brunettes react more to love. With Garbo and John Gilbert to demonstrate, girls react aplenty with running record of results showing on graph of meter. When results are interpreted, Dr. Marston declares gentlemen may prefer blondes, but brunettes prefer love scenes.
It was during this period that Elizabeth found her way to the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. And it's a good thing, too. Bill's publicity stunts weren't bringing in nearly enough money to support the three adults and four children who shared a home. Even Olive Byrne took a job writing a column for the magazine Family Circle under the pen name Olive Richard. It was militantly normal, championing motherhood and apple pie. In the column, She sometimes called on the expertise of a child psychologist named William Moulton Marston, never acknowledging that they were acquainted outside of the context of the column. Olive Richard often needed a psychologist's opinion on the hot parenting issues of the day. With the nation frantic about the terrible moral influence of comic books, she went to Bill Marston for a 1940 column titled, Don't Laugh at the Comics. In it, she worried that comics were indoctrinating children into fascist values and accused them of being full of torture, kidnapping, sadism, and other cruel business. Marston shot back. When a lovely heroine is bound to the stake, comics followers are sure that the rescue will arrive in the nick of time. The reader's wish is to save the girl, not to see her suffer. He also directly defended Superman against accusations of fascism, saying, "The two wishes behind Superman are certainly the soundest of all. They are, in fact, our national aspirations of the moment, to develop an unbeatable national might and to use this great power, when we get it, to protect innocent, peace-loving people from destructive, ruthless evil." That was enough to catch the eye of Superman creator M.C. Gaines. Gaines was the publisher of the fledgling DC Comics. Superman had debuted in 1938, and Batman first graced the pages in 1939. Bill Marston went off to work for DC Comics, and pretty soon he was pitching his own idea for a new character. As a 1992 New York Times profile put it, "One dark night, as the clouds of war hovered over Europe again, Mr. Marston consulted his wife and collaborator, also a psychologist. He was inventing somebody like that new Superman fellow, only his character would promote a global psychic revolution by forsaking Biff, Bam, and Crunch for the power of love." "Well," said Mrs. Marston, who was born liberated, "this superhero had better be a woman."
Thus, Wonder Woman was born. Though Bill Marston at first wrote under the name Charles Moulton, glimpses of his personality show through on every page. Marston developed and tirelessly championed a scientific lie detector. Wonder Woman had a golden lasso with which she could compel any person to tell the truth. Marston was interested in sexual bondage and how it could be used to give or take dominance. Wonder Woman's only weakness came if a man bound her in chains. Of course, if that was her only weakness, she had to be constantly bound in chains to keep the plot dramatic. And of course, Wonder Woman carried characteristics of both the women in Marston's life. She exclaimed, "Suffering Sappho," like Elizabeth, and her bulletproof bracelets were an homage to the bracelets Olive wore in lieu of a wedding ring. Marston would later say that Wonder Woman is psychological propaganda for the new type of woman who, I believe, should rule the world. Today we're familiar with the concept of toxic masculinity. Marston anticipated this concept with his analysis of the comics of his day, saying that they could be faulted as examples of blood-curdling masculinity. He worried that not even girls want to be girls so long as our feminine archetype lacks force, strength, and power. Not wanting to be girls, they don't want to be tender, submissive, peace-loving as good women are. Women's strong qualities have become despised because of their weakness. The obvious remedy is to create a feminine character with all the strength of Superman, plus all the allure of a good and beautiful woman. Against this backdrop, a DC Comics press release promoted the new creation. Wonder Woman was conceived by Dr. Marston to set up a standard among children and young people of strong, free, courageous womanhood, to combat the idea that women are inferior to men, and to inspire girls to self-confidence and achievement in athletics, occupations and professions monopolized by men, because the only hope for civilization is the greater freedom, development, and equality of women in all fields of human activity.
After writing Wonder Woman for just over 5 years, William Moulton Marston passed away in 1947. After his death, the character would slowly wander away from his vision. Elizabeth wrote to DC Comics asking to be entrusted with Wonder Woman's legacy. She said, "Hire me. Remember, I have known Bill since the age of 12. I suggested the original lie detector experiment and cooperated with him in his laboratory work at Harvard. My training is the same as his. AB Mount Holyoke, LLB Boston University, and MA Radcliffe. The main difference is that I insisted that he complete his work for a PhD, which I was too lazy to do. Remember also that I have been editing all my life and have helped materially in the mechanical production of Bill's books. Instead, an editorial director was given complete control of the character. The Atlantic notes that, in the 1950s and 60s, Wonder Woman pined for Trevor, who wasn't so interested anymore, and gave advice about love and marriage. She lost her magic lasso and acquired a pair of enormous breasts. All the evidence of Wonder Woman's feminist roots remained in the family's hands. Due in no small part to their unconventional family arrangement, Elizabeth Holloway Marston never shared Bill's papers with an archive. And though there was some question about how willingly Elizabeth originally entered into that family, there is no question that she and Olive continued to live as a family for 43 years, in New York and later in Tampa. When they would visit Margaret Sanger in Tucson, they slept in the same room. It was in Tampa in 1990 that Olive Byrne died at the age of 86. As biographer Jill Lepore records, while Olive was in the hospital, dying, Holloway fell and broke her hip. She was admitted to the same hospital, but they were kept in separate rooms. They'd lived together for 64 years. When Holloway, in her hospital bed, was told that Olive had died, she sang a poem by Tennyson. "Sunset and the evening star, and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea." There was no obituary. When Elizabeth passed away 3 years later, the New York Times took notice. Elizabeth Holloway Marston, who was the inspiration for the creation of the cartoon character Wonder Woman, died here on Saturday. She was 100 years old. Her husband, William Marston, created the popular cartoon character in the 1940s. When he was developing the idea for a cartoon character, he sought his wife's advice. She told him, "Come on, let's have a superwoman. There's too many men out there."
If you want to learn more about the non-traditionally feminist family that inspired Wonder Woman, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/029. The show this week owes an enormous debt to historian Jill Lepore and the work she did in researching and promoting her 2014 book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. We'll share an Amazon link to that book, as well as video of a terrific lecture she gave on Wonder Woman at the Radcliffe Institute. We'll also have video from the Smithsonian Channel exploring the earliest Wonder Woman comics. We'll link to William Moulton Marston's FBI file showing how desperately he tried to get the lie detector admitted into trials, while also falsifying its results. And we'll link to his book, The Emotions of Normal People, as well. We'll also have a link to Elizabeth Holloway Marston's 1993 obituary. In pop culture news, the big-budget Wonder Woman film starring Gal Gadot is set for release this summer. There's also an indie movie in development about the Marston family, called Professor Marston and the Wonder Women. If all goes well, it will also be released this year.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. And if you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, we'd love it if you could write us a brief review. It's the best way to help others find the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show on resurrection men in Boston, who would procure cadavers for medical students through less than legal means.